There was a moment this year when I watched someone break the rules right in front of me in the most dramatic way. Dramatic is the operative word because it was during a performance. It wasn't just in front of me. There were hundreds of people in the audience. This was during an event that I go to every year if I can make it on New Year's Day. It's a 10-hour long marathon of performances. I call it a marathon at the St. Mark's Poetry Project in a 200-year-old church in Lower Manhattan. So imagine a soaring, cavernous sanctuary with a podium on the altar up front. Mostly, the marathon is set up as a kind of churn. There are more than 150 people on the program, and it's not just poetry readings, but bands play, and there are choreographers and comedians. I've seen Patti Smith perform there and Philip Glass. And everybody only gets 2 to 3 minutes each to read or play or whatever. The time limit's a big deal because they need to fit everybody in. Occasionally, someone gets on stage in between acts and tells everybody to keep it short. Anyway, the sort of rules-shattering moment that happened was not one of the famouses on stage. It was somebody I'd never heard of.
Jerome Ellis is a composer, performer, and writer. His recent work...
Jerome Ellis, time, composer silence, and musician, but he didn't have an instrument with him or even anything to read off of. He just climbed up on stage, stood in front of the mic... And I have to admit, I was really just looking down at my program and not paying attention when he started talking.
The Brazilian state of Mato Grosso do Sul has a law mandating that cell phone companies offer a 50%.
And then he stopped talking. Like for a while. And I think it was at this point that I looked up and saw him sort of staring, wide-eyed, maybe trembling a bit. I'm playing this in real time, by the way. Normally, I'd edit these silences down, but I wanted to give you a sense of how confusing this was at first, and uncomfortable.
50%.
I had no idea what was going on. So far, he had said, the Brazilian state of Mato Grosso do Sul has a law mandating that cell phone companies offer a 50%
discount to
and then you can hear he's doing these kind of little breathy clicks and pops. And I was like, oh, it's some performance art thing, like cell phone companies, spotty coverage in Brazil.
To their customers with...
50% discount to their customers.
With...
And then he breaks into Portuguese.
Put distúrbios na temporalização e na fluência da fala. Customers with breaks in the timing and fluency of speech. That is, they're customers who have speech impediments, like myself.
So that's what was going on.
They have to... The customer has to present...
Jerome has a stutter.
A signed statement from a speech language...
A significant one.
Speech language... Speech language... pathologist to prove their pathology. I first encountered this law in a book about strange laws from around the world. The author of the book was mocking the law. But I see in the law an attempt to address the issue of temporal accessibility.
Temporal accessibility.
When it comes to disabled speech. So when I was first invited to participate in this magnificent event, I was struck by the 2-minute time limit, which later became a 2-to-3-minute time limit. And I understood intuitively that the purpose of this time limit was to create as non-hierarchical a space as possible. But in removing one hierarchy, the time limit introduces another. A time limit assumes that all people have relatively equal access to time through their speech, which is not true. Stuttering is very unpredictable. I can rehearse something as many times as I want, but I don't actually know how long it will take to say anything until I have to say it.
What you just heard is about half of Jerome's performance, as he performed it that night, my commentary notwithstanding. It clocks in at about 5 minutes, practically twice the length permitted itself. I'll play you the second half in a bit, but in just those 5 minutes, I'd gone from barely paying attention to being totally rapt. Everybody was. The pauses continued, some of them longer than what you just heard, and in an enormous room packed with people, there was barely any other sound. I don't remember hearing a cough or a paper rustle. We were all just kind of spellbound. Partly, I think, because, as Jerome said himself, what was happening on stage seemed so very unpredictable. That's what it felt like in the audience. And in the weeks and months since then, I realized I just had all these questions for Jerome. The way you wish you could call up the person who made the weird, obscure movie you just saw that you can't get out of your head, or who wrote the book you just read. I just wanted to know how he thought of what he did, how it felt to do that. Jerome.
Sean, hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well.
So I called him.
And you, how
on
are you?
Skype.
I'm
He's got
right.
the friendliest
I'm
face
right. Whoops,
and hadn't had a haircut in a while, like everybody.
My friend Kyle.
Jerome told me he got the idea after the director of the Poetry Project sent him an email inviting him to perform and mentioned the time limit. And just reading that gave him this twinge of stress.
And I was like, I noted the stress and I was like, oh, I think I'm interested in going towards that stress and like exploring that.
He says that confusion I felt at first, that's what he was going for. Because it's so common for people to have that feeling upon meeting him. They don't know what's going on until he tells them. It's not easy to bring hundreds of people simultaneously into an experience you live every day, but he managed it. I also wondered if he had kind of improvised what he was going to say, but he says he wrote it all out ahead of time and rehearsed it, reading it off his phone while walking down the street, which was way easier than reciting it on stage, he says. What was the shortest amount of time that it took when you were preparing, when you were rehearsing it?
I would say, I would say 2.5 minutes.
2.5 minutes, got it.
Yeah.
And that was important to him, he says, to write something that someone who didn't stutter could recite within the time limit. So in that way, he was simultaneously adhering to the rules and breaking them at the same time. And since stuttering is unpredictable, Jerome says there was a chance the whole thing could have taken him only 4 minutes. Then it was a funny situation where stuttering less might have made it harder for people to understand the point he was trying to make. I figured simply being on stage would make him more likely to stutter. But Jerome says no.
It's in fact quite soothing to be on stage because it's like, you know, it's like I actually feel that I have the time. And in some ways, the stage audience relationship is a more temporally accessible environment than other environments of verbal communication that I engage with.
Like when he worked at the Columbia Law Library. Just to give you some background of his life offstage. Jerome worked at the circulation desk, and not only did he have to take in calls, but he had to transfer calls to other people. So answering the phone, that's one temporal expectation. And then having to explain to someone else who's calling while the first person's on hold, now he's squashed between two temporal expectations. It was stressful. Also, this show, and radio in general, is not usually an accessible environment for differently abled speakers. I'm leaving in a lot of Jerome's stutters in the interview part of this story, but I'm still cutting out some of his pauses and repeats, and mine for that matter. As a group of professionals, we're biased toward more fluid talkers. I became acutely aware of that while editing our conversation. And just to let you know, I tried to quote-unquote clean up his answers as little as possible, because I want to bring you into Jerome's daily experience too. Anyway, I think Jerome stuttered less than usual on the call with me because I know he stutters. He says it helps to disclose it, relaxes him. And then there are other subtler ways that he's able to tame it sometimes when he's talking to people.
Sometimes I refer to it as my stutter, but sometimes I refer to it as the stutter.
The stutter.
Because to me, stuttering is not bound to my body, that it is a phenomenon that occurs between me and whoever I'm speaking to. Like, I like to think of it like it's something that we share.
And when Jerome's in a conversation with someone, he stutters partly because the burden to talk smoothly is only on him.
Exactly, exactly. One way of saying it that's like, oh, he's stuttering, but there's another way that's like, there is a stutter happening, you know?
And we are both contending with it.
Exactly.
And his talk at the Poetry Project was that on a grand scale. That's what he wanted, for each of us to shoulder a little of the weight of the stutter that was happening. The reason for those long silences on stage is something that I didn't know either. Jerome's particular kind of stutter is sometimes called a glottal block. The way he explains it, when your vocal cords are at rest, they're apart. And then when you go to talk, they come together and vibrate. But sometimes Jerome's vocal cords get stuck in the middle between being at rest and touching. So he can still make little sounds with his teeth and tongue and lips, but not his voice. And talking to him on Skype, the same thing would happen as when he was on stage. When the glottal block came, he got this look, a kind of frozen, wide-eyed stare, like he was stunned. Except on stage, it was more dramatic. His face would turn upward. And I remember thinking to myself, is that just effort? Is it fear?
Yeah, and I know the look you're speaking about. Yeah, it's like some stutters will, their body will in fact move a lot while they're stuttering. Their face will move in certain ways, which I do sometimes. But in general, my body response is actually is a freezing, and I stop breathing often too. Just like it feels like everything stops for a second or 5 seconds or longer. So part of it is that I'm freezing. Part of it feels like my body goes into a kind of supplication or prayer almost. I have a friend who once referred to it as watching me ask for the word. And wait, you know.
And wait for it to come.
Wait for it to come, yeah. And because I often look up. It's a very specific state. It's like, there are some ways in which I like totally leave the room. And I think that speaks to the looking upward. And I then just I'll come back once the word arrives.
And it wasn't fear, he says. He does have a lot of fears in his daily life. Taking too much of someone's time. Not being able to order at Shake Shack when there's a line behind him. But this wasn't that. If he was afraid of anything, it was falling back on the tactics he usually uses to get around a stutter. Synonyms, for example. Swapping out a word he's blocked on for one that's easier to say. He didn't want to do that on stage.
And I didn't realize that until now, that I think that was the primary fear. And I did do that like 2 or 3 times, and I regretted it afterwards.
Do you remember which words you did it on by any chance?
Yes.
To their customers with...
So there's the Portuguese word...
With...
Distúbio.
Distúbios na temporalização.
which I had literally translated to, in my text, I translated it, to disturbance. And as you just saw, that word is still like very hard for me to say. So what I did in the performance was
customers with,
I said breaks in the timing and fluency of speech. And that was one that I didn't like that I did that. What I wanted to do was what I just did with you. It's just wait for the word.
For
it. But it was especially D's. They can be really painful. So I avoided that one. And I was frustrated with myself as soon as it happened. Like breaks to me, it doesn't capture what I wanted to capture.
Are names particularly difficult?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because there's no synonyms for them, you know?
Jerome blocks on his own name. Has since he was 4 years old when his stutter started. So now, trying to say his name or any name, he says it's like he's four again.
I even in some situations for a few years, I would say John. John is my middle name. But very interestingly, I then began stuttering on John. And then I would start saying Sean. And because sometimes the sh sound is easy, like the j sound has a harder attack.
And also, you know, obviously Sean is just an incredibly beautiful name.
And that was really, I mean, that was my main reasoning for doing it. I was just like, well, if I'm gonna choose a new name, why don't I just go straight for the top?
Just go for the top, man.
So, you know, and then I started centering on that, you know? I mean, I just find that that's so beautiful. It's like, it's always outpacing me in a way.
You find that beautiful that it's outpacing you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I find it painful too, but I find it a deep beauty in that.
What is the beauty?
Well, for me, it's this quality that it's like, the stutter, it feels like this thing that is so deeply entwined with my body, my mind, my emotions, everything. And yet I can't figure it out, or I can't grasp it. And even more so, like when I think I have grasped it, like when I think I've outsmarted it even, like by switching my name, mm-hmm. There's something about just how elusive it is.
The second half of Jerome's performance was just one sentence. It took him 4 minutes and 9 seconds to get through, partly because it had a name at the beginning.
The Black Feminist.
The sentence begins, "The Black feminist scholar Kimberly Crenshaw once wrote," and then a quote. Climbing on top of Crenshaw's name alone took him about 1:45. I haven't paused the recording of the performance, by the way. It's still running underneath this.
My chest was hurting so much. And while I was doing it, I was like, God, should I just like give up and leave, you know? And I was like, no. I mean, I've done that so many, like, I mean, there's so many moments in life where I just stop speaking because I just don't want to put in the labor of finishing my thought. Or finishing my sentence. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that here. I wanted to show the audience the labor that's involved. And this is labor that I often or sometimes won't put in.
The Black feminist scholar.
But it was around this moment that the feeling in the room started to change again. There was no more confusion, obviously. And any concern or tension was gone, too.
Black feminist scholar.
by this point, the importance of what Jerome was saying had landed on us. And the marriage between the thing he was saying and the way he was saying it. Like a poem elongated. So it just took us a little longer to catch up.
Kimberly Crenshaw once wrote,
I'm going to stop the recording for a second and just read you the quote so you can sit with it during this last part. It goes, treating different things the same can generate as much an inequality as treating the same things differently. Did you feel kind of punk rock to be doing that, or like badass to be like?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like it was an act of resistance. And like I'm, as a musician, the first music I studied really deeply was jazz. And I remember very distinctly when I was in middle school that I would have my jazz CDs at home, and often they would be like four tracks because each track would be like 9 minutes long. And then I remember like looking at my friend's CDs of punk rock, for example, as you mentioned, and like, you know, much shorter tracks. And I remember noticing that age and like thinking about what that meant. And there would be this refusal to adhere to the length of a pop song, for example, you know. And for me, there was always a racialized element there too, that there's like a black resistance against certain structures of time, that like, no, this track is 11 minutes long, and like if you don't listen to it, then don't listen to it, but like I'm like we're like, our, what we're trying to achieve in this music is different in some ways than what a 3 minute song is trying to achieve.
Treating.
As a black person, I'm also thinking about the way that time and access to time is racially inflected. You know, there are many moments in the world when
at treating
a person of color is just not given as much time to speak.
Treating different things the same way. May generate as much inequality as treating the same things in different ways. Thank you.
Jerome Ellis.